The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on January 8, 2006. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see you all today. This morning I thought I would tell a story. That's one that I have referred to a number of times, but I've never really told the whole story and talked about it at length, but there's a lot of interesting things there. Not that we're going to exhaust it this morning, but it's the story of a fellow who came to the Buddha. Malunkyaputta was his name. Came to the Buddha after his meditation one day and demanded that the Buddha answer some questions for him, some very, very deep, supposedly, very deep metaphysical questions that we might have about our life here. And he asked the Buddha, there were 10 questions. Strictly speaking, there's only 4, but, or maybe we could say there's 16, depending on how you look at it. But he managed to work it into 10. And the questions are, is the universe eternal or is it not eternal? That's 2. Third one is the universe infinite or is it finite? That's 4 now. Is the soul the same as the body, identical to the body, or is the soul or the self perhaps separate, different, distinct from the body? Now we have 6. And then finally the last 4 making 10, he said, does the Tathagata would be, that's one of the names of Buddha. Does the Tathagata exist after death? Or does the Tathagata not exist after death? Or does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death? Or does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after death? We can get, there's basically 4 questions. Is the universe eternal? Is it infinite? Is the soul identical with the body? Does the Tathagata exist after death? And with each one of these, we can get yes, no, both, and neither. So we could get 16. But why they ended up with that particular 10, I don't know. I don't know that it matters. This fellow then, Malunkyaputta, he demanded answers to these questions. He wanted the Buddha to answer these questions. And he said, otherwise, he said, if I'm going to follow the path with you, then I expect you to answer these questions. And if you don't answer these questions for me, then I will no longer follow this way. And if it is that you can't answer these questions, he said, then it would just be a straightforward matter for you just to simply say so. So there it is. He puts his ultimatum to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, Malunkyaputta, he said, did I ever tell you that I was going to answer these questions for you? Malunkyaputta said, no, sir. Did you ever come to me and say, I will follow the path with the Buddha and he will explain these questions to me? And Malunkyaputta said, no, sir. He said, well, even now, do I tell you that if you follow this path with me, I will explain these questions for you? And he said, no, sir. And he said, even you now, you don't say to me that if I follow this path with the Buddha, he will explain these questions for me. The Buddha then says, well, who is refusing whom here? Then he goes on to say, the Buddha goes on to say, Malunkyaputta, you could die before I can explain these questions for you. There's something far more serious here. And here he gets into the story then of the man shot with the arrow. He says, suppose there was a man shot with a poisoned arrow and his friends bring him to the surgeon. But before he allows the surgeon to do anything to help, he demands the name of the man who shot me with this arrow. I want to know what clan he is from. I want to know what caste he belongs to. I want to know his village. I want to know the bow that he shot the arrow from. I want to know how it was strung, he says. I want to know what kind of feather was used on the arrow. I want to know the material the point of the arrow was made from. And Buddha said he'll die. He'll die before he has any of these questions answered. This is the situation that the man, Mullankaputta, was in but didn't realize. But there, like a foolish man on his deathbed dying, wants to have all these things answered when they are irrelevant to the problem that he is suffering from. There's something urgent and necessary right now in this moment, and the man was sidetracked onto other things that he wanted to discuss, that he was interested in. He wanted to find out, and that might be so. He wants to find these things out. But there's this urgent need of the moment that he's ignoring, and that is that he's been shot with a poisoned arrow, and he's going to die. So the Buddha said, I have not explained these things for you because they aren't necessary. They aren't necessary for the problem that you suffer from. They aren't conducive to awakening. They won't help you in any way to awaken from this folly, this pain and suffering. They won't help you to awaken to the reality of dukkha. Nor will they show you the arising of dukkha or the cessation of dukkha or the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha. And for this reason, I don't bother with these things. Other places, too, where the Buddha has told his monks, where one time they were sitting in a forest, a Singsapa forest, and there on the forest floor, the Buddha gathered up a few leaves in his hands, and he said, monks, the leaves I'm holding in my hand, they said, are they many or few compared to the leaves in the trees overhead? And of course the monks said, well, they are very few compared to the leaves in the trees overhead. And the Buddha said, like so. He said, what I have told you is very little compared to everything that I could tell you about all sorts of things. But I don't tell you. I only tell you this little bit. This is important to understand, that our practice, our path, our way is, in a sense, it's broad in the sense that it covers virtually every aspect of our life. But what it is that we need to attend to is rather confined and small. I don't know, maybe confined isn't really the proper word. But it is not huge, it is not vast, it is not complicated. We make the complications and the trouble within our own minds. We sidetrack ourselves within our own minds with all sorts of things that we want to know about. You know, so what the Buddha then going on, he said, that's why I haven't told you these things. He said, what I have told you is what I teach, what I point out to you is dukkha, that is your suffering, your pain, your confusion about existence here, just being here. I have pointed this out to you. I've shown you how it arises. I show you how it ceases. And I have shown you the path or the way by which we can bring about the cessation of this dukkha. This is what I teach. This is what this practice is. This is what this way is. Well, there's a lot in this story that we could look at. But just going back to the beginning, the attitude, the approach of this fellow, Mullankaputta, comes to the Buddha. He'd been with him a while now, studying with him, practicing. He was in his meditation, actually, when he suddenly got up to go over and ask the Buddha this question, or these 10 questions. So he wasn't a novice. He'd been at it a while. But he had all these other concerns in his mind. He had his own agenda. He had his own ideas about what it was that he wanted to learn. Of course, that wasn't what the Buddha was there to teach. In other words, he was going to try to tell the Buddha what it is that I want you to teach me. Very often when we take this way up, any way for that matter, we'll come into a new situation with all of our old ideas about what are the concerns here, what it is I want you to show me. Be like, say, if you're very familiar with, you knew, you know, how you think in terms of baseball, you know, and you know the game baseball very well, and you play baseball, And now you hear about this other way, this other game, you know, called football. And then you want to know about football, and you run into someone who can show you the way to play football. But before we do any of that, I want you to tell me, though, how many bases do you have in that game? And it's, we don't have any bases. You don't have any bases? What kind of bats do you use? Well, we don't use bats. What do you mean you don't use bats? And as you're describing, perhaps you hear the fellow talk about how on a fumble the guys are scampering here and there over the field because the ball is bouncing in different directions and things. And you wait a minute, what do you mean the ball is bouncing in different directions? Doesn't it just bounce in one direction and roll? Well, no, because the ball isn't round, you see. It's not a sphere. The ball is not a sphere, you say? And you call it a ball? This doesn't even make sense, you know? And what you see, as long as the person remains fixed on what they know and what they're familiar with, and they have the rules lined up, now you're introduced to some other way. And we forget to set down, maybe not in that case, it's a pretty simple little case, just an analogy, but we forget to put aside our assumptions, our ideas about things. And we often get some very lofty notions about Buddhism and the Buddha way, that this seems to involve this thing called enlightenment and awakening and total freedom from our fears and anxieties, and we can find a peaceful life and all of this. But we might have all kinds of ideas about just what this entails and how it is that I would like to find this kind of peace and that sort of thing for me, you see. And we might hear that, well, this is a religion, you see, so perhaps we've followed a religious way or we're familiar with a religious way because we've been brought up in a particular culture. And we drag into this discussion then all of our ideas surrounding this inquiry that we are making into, the way of the Buddha, the way that the Buddha is practicing. Because what it is that the Buddha shows and what the Buddha offers is something very, in a sense, very small. It's all pervasive. It touches everything. But it just involves a very tiny amount here, in a sense, of what it is that we need to do. We come loaded with all kinds of ideas, all kinds of expectations from the teacher, from the practice. And by golly, I expect it to deliver what it is that I expect it to deliver. Of course, we're not open to what this is about. It's also interesting, too, that Mulung Thapudha, he said that if you can't answer these questions, he said it would be a very simple, straightforward thing for you just simply to say so. But you notice that the Buddha didn't say that. He didn't say, well, no, I can't answer those questions. Because, in a sense, the Buddha could answer those questions. But actually, in another sense, he can't answer the questions. But it's not that he can't answer the questions because he doesn't understand. Is because what he understands makes all of these questions moot. These aren't even real questions. They're off spinning in air. These are questions formed out of our ignorant assumptions about reality and about how it is. That it must be infinite or finite or one or the other or this or that. Either we exist after death or we do not. All these kinds of things. But what we don't understand and what this fellow doesn't understand is that there's something far more subtle about reality that he's missing altogether. And so, like the person clinging to his notions about baseball and then trying to have football explained to him in terms of baseball, he isn't going to get anywhere and it's going to seem kind of ridiculous and crazy. Like so, this person is demanding something of the Buddha that has put himself, he's put himself in a place where he's undermining himself. He is not going to be able to understand what it is that the Buddha points out in this very, very simple teaching because he is so loaded with these ideas. But the Buddha also understands, rather than wasting time explaining how it is that these questions are actually kind of meaningless, that they're formed out of your ignorance, it might not hurt to point that out, but beyond that, to go beyond it and explain how that is the case, it's much more important, much more urgent that we get right to the task at hand, and that is to start attending to just what this is and what it is that the Buddha has been pointing out. The nature of this suffering, this dukkha, how it arises, how it ceases, and the way to bring about its cessation. In the process of doing this, when we arrive at this point where we finally begin to see what it is that troubles us, this dukkha, we start to become aware of that in our life. Then we can begin also to see its origin, where it is coming from. We can see how that can be brought to an end. And we will understand this way, this practice, that brings it to an end. And in doing that, all of these other kinds of questions, these big metaphysical questions that we might have about, well, about me, and where am I going, where did I come from, what will happen to me after I die, all of that stuff, dies away. It dies away when we begin to realize the nature of reality itself and how it is here. We will start to see how it is that these questions are formed out of our ignorance of how things are. For this reason, then, the Buddha didn't waste any time there. This is important for us to understand. But I think the most important thing that we can get out of this lesson is this matter of realizing that when we come to anything at all, really, but certainly when we come to this practice, when we come to this teaching, that it is something radically different from what we normally do, from what we normally think, from what we normally grasp and hold. And we have to recognize that. We have to recognize the demands, the insistence that we put on the teacher, on the teaching, on the practice, expecting it to deliver certain things that we have defined as, this is what I want it to do for me, as opposed to allowing it to express itself, to show itself for what it is, which is something very simple, very rational, very down to earth, very sane. So it is important that we watch our own mind and watch what it is that we bring to this practice, to this teaching, to this learning, and to realize how we need to just set that aside. Because just as it was with Melanchthapuddha, after he asked the Buddha these questions, the Buddha, he didn't bother to deal with those questions at all. He just simply pointed out, did I ever tell you I was going to answer these questions? Oh, no, you didn't. All right. Now we got that clarified. So, this is what I show you. This is what this teaching is about. It's about human suffering, how it originates, how it can be brought to an end, and the way to do that. That's all this is. Anything else that you've got in mind, that's fine. You can deal with that somewhere else. But that is what this teaching is. So, you know, you shouldn't expect the teacher. I remember one time early on as a Zen student, an older Zen student told me that the teacher was there to help you with your problems, to help you solve your problems, that sort of thing. That's not what the teacher is there for. Teacher isn't there to help you solve your problems. Teacher is there to help you realize just what your problem is. But what your problem truly is probably isn't anything that you're thinking about. You're thinking about all kinds of other things. And so when the teacher never pays too much attention to that, doesn't deal with that very much, but instead tries to get you to notice something else, but if you keep locked onto your agenda, your ideas about what your problems are, you're not going to hear what's being pointed out. But were you to follow this way, this simple way, just to step out of that little rat's nest of entanglements that you're constantly caught up with. All of us are. You know, this is my entanglements too when I'm at Katagiri. But if you just learn to step out of that and realize what the real situation is, that will take care of itself. Even these huge existential questions of what it's all about are taken care of And they're taken care of not because we come up with an answer. The answer will just continue to embroil us in the entanglements and the confusion. These questions are resolved not through being answered. These questions are resolved through seeing directly the nature of reality. And what we come to realize, this I can tell you, you can take it or leave it. I don't really care because it isn't a matter. I don't expect you to believe it. I want you to see it for yourself by and by. But these kinds of questions just simply don't arise. They're not real questions that have anything to do with reality, but are born of our confusion. Any questions about anything? Yeah, Mike.
Well, it is true that the Buddha said that he could not help us with the eating food problem. Isn't it true that the teacher can help you with the 84th problem, which is not wanting to have the other 83?
Yeah. We want to be free of our problems. Yeah. Yeah, so those are our endless 83 problems. Yeah. And so that's what we're focused on. And we want the Buddha to fix those for us. We want this practice, this way, this teaching to fix those 83 problems, you know. But that's not what this is about. You got all these personal problems. And you want to be free of them. Yeah, okay. But you know, human beings, we have problems. Even though you get rid of some of them, you know, there'll still be others. You're not going to get rid of them all. There'll always be one kind of problem. But that isn't really what your problem is. You see. What our real problem is that 84th problem. Yeah. And yes, that's what this way deals with. Because if we can deal with that 84th problem, these 83 problems, you know, our normal everyday problems, cease to be a real problem. You know, they're not really problems for us. Kind of like that time when I thought, gee, I'm supposed to, somehow it didn't seem right to me. And my teacher, Roshi, was there to solve my problems for me. But I was told that he was, so I went to him. And to tell him my problem, he practically laughed me out of the room, you know. He just said, you don't have any problems. Of course, it was true. And I kind of knew that. And this was shortly before I found out I had cancer. And then it seemed like I had a problem now. But, you know, it turned out it really, you know, I mean, I don't mean by and by because I've survived it now for so many years now, but because I didn't know I was going to survive it. It was a very bad situation and looked like I wasn't going to survive more than a few months, actually, for a while there. So it seemed like I had a real problem. But when I just stepped into the moment and took care of the moment, there was no problem there. No problem there. And even though, yes, one of the 83 problems was I had cancer, you know, okay. But, you know, I had a number of other things, too. We all do. But if you can learn to live your life completely, wholly, totally, just burn up your life in each moment, completely, with no residue. You just here. Just be here. Come back to here. Where's your problem? What is your problem? Okay, here's a problem. Deal with it. Deal with it totally, wholeheartedly. To go into it. Burn yourself up in it. It's human life. It's something wonderful, incredible, this problem that you have. You really don't want to have any problems? Do you realize how bland, you know? That life will become. No. There's a kind of, we have to just kick over into a more subtle way of living our life and seeing it and realizing it for what it is. That's what the Buddha is directing us to. Knowing that when you do that, then all this other stuff that you wanted to discuss, we don't need to discuss it anymore. It's no longer an issue for you. It's just set that aside. So he wants directly to just bring us back to this. Of course, we don't believe it. We think, well, wait, but I got these problems. And you see, but yeah, okay, deal with it as best you can. But in the meantime, let's get down to what we really need to do. That's what this way is. That's what this practice is. And if you learn to take it up, to really take it up, I don't mean to play taking it up, but to really take it up. I'm talking about your life. to live your life, to consume it and burn it in each moment, you won't have a problem. You will not have a problem. I mean, even with these big ones. You know, all the problems really are, by the way, are the little problems. You know that? That the big problems are, in a sense, false. Once we see what's going on, they aren't really problems. They aren't really issues. So in a sense, all we have are these little, they're in the little details of our life. Let's take care of those. But let's do it with awakening, you know, rather than with buying into the problem like, oh, it must be so, and just, you know. No, let's do it with awakening, seeing the whole picture, never leaving the realization that our life is unfolding in the whole and not in the little fragments that we're constantly fighting with and struggling with and trying to fix up and straighten out and push away and gather up and all of that. You following me on that? Does that make any sense? Yeah. This is a subtle way. But again, like I said, the most important point I think that we can learn from this lesson is to realize when we come to this practice, to this teaching, realize we're coming with, and I wanted to solve this thing for me. Forget whatever that is. Just come to it. Never mind what it is that you wanted to solve. I guarantee you that two things will happen. If it's a small problem, you'll be able to deal with it. If it's a big one, it'll cease to be a real issue. That's what this way of life ultimately brings us to, if we really take it up. Of course, that's the issue. We have to really take it up. We can't just say we're going to take it up or pretend we'll take it up. We have to take it up. It's a moment-by-moment practice. We call that every minute Zen. You know, that nobody can do perfectly, and I certainly can't, you know. But moment after moment, whenever you just recollect yourself and give it your best shot in each moment, over and over again, we can get better and better at doing that. But that's our way. Yeah. Mark.
Today, once again, assert the difference as regards the teaching of Buddhism. You've done this on several occasions. It seems to me that to assert difference in the face of unity seems to be a little bit strange. So that the question is, are both difference and unity poisoned arrows?
Yeah. Yeah, they both are. Don't grab either one. Yeah. When we speak, we talk, we practice, we live out our lives as separate selves here, and we can't ignore that or deny that. Now we have the world of difference, but it's a poisoned arrow. Yeah, it's a poisoned arrow only if we grasp it. If we don't grasp it, it might still be a poisoned arrow, but you see, if we grasp it, we you know, in effect, stab ourselves in the hand with it, you might say. And then we think, then this world of difference, that's so poisonous. So that, I mean, then we think that too, like Buddhism is teaching us then, because we're so caught up with these dualities of good and evil and that sort of thing. Samsara, nirvana, and delusion and enlightenment. You're always pairing things off. In Buddhism, we talk that way too. But we should understand it's not with the idea that the one is bad and the other one's good. They're both poisoned arrows if we grasp them. You know, it isn't that delusion is not as good as enlightenment. Enlightenment is so much better than delusion. Enlightenment and delusion are together in the same place. And if we grasp the one, the delusion, well, of course, that's not so good. And what is enlightenment? Well, enlightenment is, in effect, just letting it go and seeing it for what it is. But what we'll do is that we'll turn enlightenment into a thing, and we'll grasp that. And that becomes like a poisoned arrow. You see, the same thing. We'll go after enlightenment. We'll think this practice, this way, is about going after enlightenment, after some particular thing, but that's not it at all. So we learn to let that go. Then in living in this way without grasping either one, then we can live in enlightenment. We live in enlightenment right there in the muddy water, with delusion itself. But we're not caught up in it. We're not taken in by it. We don't give those things the heavy weight and solidity and mass and substance that we think they have. Yes?
Something along a similar vein. Someone asked Buddha to answer some questions, and he said, I have no obligation to you. You have no obligation to me. Could you say something about that?
The Buddha said, I have no obligation to you? I don't recall that particular teaching, but I can understand it. It's true that the teacher, in a sense, doesn't have any obligation to the student as a kind of a personal obligation. I don't have an obligation to you. Things don't get reduced down to, here's a student, here's the teacher, and we're dealing with specific things that the teacher's going to help you with. That's really true. For example, In my teaching, the teaching that I do, basically I just throw it out there. Some of you I've gotten to know over the years. I see some new faces. I hope maybe I can get to know a few more of you, maybe in time. But whether I do or not, it's always the same for me. Even somebody I meet outside of this context here, it's still always the same for me. If I can do something that might help the person see, I'll do it. And if not, well, then I'll wait. And it's just like that. But I'm not obligated to a particular person in some way. And it's not like I teach out of an obligation to teach. I'll teach because, well, I have to teach. For example, if you show up here and you're all looking at me, you're all kind of curved around looking at me here, well, now I have to say something. So I do it. If I were to walk into this room and nobody's here, well, I'm not going to sit down and start talking now. So it's not exactly an obligation. It's just something that has to be done. Another thing, too, I've told this before, too. Like somebody once asked my teacher, how many people have you helped with your teaching? And he said, it's not my business. That's not my business isn't to help other people with my teaching. My business is to teach. My business is to do the best I can do in each moment to show this way, this teaching, this practice. The obligation of the student, too. The student isn't obligated to the teacher. And so that's the other thing, too. I don't want anything from any of you, really. I don't need anything. I don't want anything. I'm very thankful and appreciative of the fact that you all show up here and that sort of thing. This is all wonderful. It allows us, gives us a place to practice and all of that. And this is wonderful. And I appreciate that very much. But personally, I don't want anything from you at all. What I would like to say, I would like to see, let's all wake up. Let's see if we can do that. That'd be wonderful, but I don't, whether you're awake in the next moment or not, doesn't matter. It's all the same. So in that way, no obligation, but it is a matter of we just take this up, each one of us. Teacher, student, doesn't matter. It's all the same, and those positions can switch very easily. But it's a matter of are we awake in this moment or not, and what can we do to help each other to enter into this moment and to be present, to be awake, to be here. That's what we need to learn to do. That's what I'm concerned with mostly here, is to try to find a way to do this. We've inherited a long tradition, comes through different cultures and things. Some things might be distracting, get us sidetracked onto other kinds of things. So gotta watch out for that. Other things, as the Buddha pointed out, aren't useful, aren't helpful. We should be careful of those kinds of things too. But what is it that we can do to help get this teaching correct? This is what we need to do. But there's no kind of personal obligation that I feel about it toward anyone in particular. I will just continue to teach whenever somebody shows up. And as a student too, I'll be open to learn whenever teaching is being offered. But get the personal kind of thing out of it altogether. We're better off. Doesn't mean that we aren't persons and that we don't have personalities and that we can form friendships and relationships and things like that. Certainly, that's true of the human world. But again, that's like, you know, we're talking about baseball now, when in fact what we're dealing with here is football. You know, that's another thing altogether. So I don't know. Did that answer your question? Yeah. But puts an obligation, though, not an obligation, but it puts the responsibility on the student then to learn. Because oftentimes, too, the student will expect the teacher is responsible for my learning. No, teacher's responsible to offer, to point things out, to lay out this teaching. But it's the student's responsibility. For each one of us, you have to learn. At some point, I realized with my teacher, it was me. I had to take it up. Not him. He was offering things, you know, there's kind of out there. And it was for me to take it up. You know, not for him to spoon feed me or something like that. Did I see another hand over here? Oh, yes.
Coming back to your story about asking and expecting answers. For me, attending to each moment is also a form of questioning, in which you don't necessarily expect an answer to a particular question that is built on concepts, but you attend to that moment which contains the question, the concept of the question, and by doing that you see the nature of that itself. I wonder if you can comment on questioning as a process in our practice that can be used for our practice, because we cannot, I mean, I don't want to have the idea that not questioning is just going in and just attending to mechanical things, thinking happens. And
yeah, thinking happens. But if we form the expectation in our questioning that we want a specific answer for something, that I think is an error. And certainly if we come in with the idea that, well, I think I know what the answer is, or I know what the problem is, I want a solution to this particular problem. As I already said in my talk, that's definitely not the approach to take. But even just to sit here and to be present and open with things, if a question arises in our mind, which is what I think maybe what you're saying, if...
Watching the questioning mind.
Well, if the questioning mind is there, if that's what's manifesting in the moment, just be aware of that. Yeah, but don't fixate on or make demands about getting an answer. Yeah, because as I said, the small problems will have practical solutions, perhaps, or maybe they won't. But they're small, really. Anyway, we busy ourselves. We think some of these things are so consequential, and yet probably they aren't. But the big ones will, in staying with them and not trying to come up with some conceptual explanation, you will begin to see that the question itself is being formed out of a conceptual construct that doesn't have any foundation to it. And that's why the whole thing begins to dissolve away by and by. These things, we get to a point finally where we realize there just isn't any foundation to any of that, and we're actually free of it. But we arrive at that by really attending very carefully to our mind and to that questioning mind as it arises. Worst thing we can do is then finally come up with some answer, particularly an answer to some metaphysical question, and say, ah, that's it. Then we lock onto that. And that's how we end up creating wars and you know, fights and human misery on a grand scale, you know, through that sort of thing. It's all a lot of foolishness, really. But it's serious business, because we cause so much suffering that way. Okay, was there anything else? Yes?
It would seem that the preoccupation with ourselves is at the root of our large metaphysical problems, even though those might seem like rational questions, emotionally based, when you get down to it, and even our smaller problems, that there's an unnecessary heaviness to those because of our preoccupation with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's it. We take ourselves far too seriously. Yeah, if we could learn to let go of that one, at least a little bit, it'll start to give us some relief. Yeah. And look, just even as some of the big sweeping problems in the world, often you will watch your own mind and you'll see yourself concerned for your little self here. Some huge things happening there, but you get, you're fearful for yourself. Oh, you're fearful for your friends, your way of life, a lot of that too, sure. Okay, but it's really just, we always put it in terms of ourself. And we're missing something there. So if we look very carefully, we'll realize that there's no foundation for that fear. But that's it. Yeah, we take ourselves too seriously. Yeah. That's the grand illusion that the Buddha pointed out. But of course, it is so subtle and so profound that it's difficult for us to understand it. And, the fact that we don't find a self. Of course, then people really misunderstand. They'll say things like, well, geez, all you have to do is go look in the mirror. I mean, you can see. And they're completely missing. There's something, of course, I know. Buddha understood that. Do you think, how stupid do you think he is? No, doesn't it occur to you we're talking about something far more subtle? It's right there in your life all the time. And it gets you entangled in all sorts of things. But it's based on what? You have never been able to find what the foundation of it is. And there isn't any. Once you see that, then you're released from these things. And even the big sweeping problems can arise in the world. And you're okay. You don't need to live in fear and trembling. We don't have to, as a nation, go running off developing some crazy Office of Homeland Security that is just completely messing up everything. So then when a hurricane strikes, everything's out of whack. And, it's because it was like people in a panic. People in a panic dismantle something that was actually functional and very helpful, all because they're so focused on something else. And, of course, then we have the people who want to drive the fear into people to make them more compliant with different things, all kinds of stuff going on there. But this is human folly and delusion. But the thing is, you don't have to be taken in by any of that. You don't. That's where your power lies. Right there with your own mind. Never mind what other people are doing and how crazy the world gets around you. And it's going to get crazy, I suspect. I think we've seen nothing yet. But you have to get grounded and sane within yourself and to live fearlessly. And you can if you're grounded and sane and you're not going to be tossed away by madness. Even if the whole culture and goes crazy around you, you don't have to do that. If you follow this way, if you learn this way, if you penetrate the subtlety of it, you'll be free of that. Well, probably gone on long enough here, so maybe we'll end it this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.